It had great bones. It had great, you know, real wood paneling. The room where they used to lay out the bodies, you know, for and had people come, it was a perfect room for membership meetings and stewards meetings. And so we bought it and had it rehabbed, and it worked really well for a number of years. And then we finally outgrew it because we were doing so much professional development and so many, you know, master's degree cohorts and so many professional pay cohorts and or classes and so on. We kind of outgrew it, and we either had to put a second story on it or find someplace else. So I decided that we'd look elsewhere, and we bought a building from an old retired Swede who was and his wife, who wanted to retire and go to Florida and jettison their interests, a realty interests anyway. And so we bought the building that we're in now, and we totally rehabbed. It was just an empty, wet warehouse. There wasn't anything in it. And no walls, nothing. And so I designed it the way I wanted it, and had good help from one of my staff guys, and the two of us basically oversaw the building of what now is a really good professional campus. And the Union campus is where we deliver all the professional development. We have membership meetings, stewards meetings, retiree meetings. Community people use it. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really been very, very serviceable. So that's another thing I'm proud of, is getting that building and designing it so that it works as well as it does.
Right.
There's about 10 meeting rooms, and we also in the back left part of it as a warehouse, so that we had a place to put stuff for what we call the school store. The school district used to go around and collect things from businesses to give to teachers, that teachers could come and take to use in their classrooms, to use with kids, to use for projects, furniture for their classrooms, whatever. The school district wanted to get out of that business because they wanted the warehouse space, and they didn't want to pay the person to do it anymore as one of their budget cutting. So I said, well, we'll do it. So we do take care now of have a school store where businesses will call and say, you know, come and get these strips of leather from one of the Wilson leather, and the teachers can use it then for lanyards or for the kids, or they can weave it or make bracelets out of it, or, you know, put beads on it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then some banks will change their logo or their address or something, and then they send us the envelopes and the paper and stuff. And art stores send used poster board, and people, when their garage sale is done, bring things that didn't sell, or people bring us magazine collections from years and years of magazines. And anyway, it's been a help for teachers in that, you know, they're always scrounging for stuff.
Yes.
And that place is full of stuff.
You want to take a break a bit?
Sure. That I have one out.
Okay. Why don't we start talking about...
Well, before you do that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but sure. I forgot that I did a recent trip to Sweden. I'd always been bugging them to send me to Sweden because, of course, I got relatives in Sweden. But so I went to the Swedish convention of Swedish teachers maybe 3-4 years ago, and wrote a big report on it that I think is maybe still on the website on the International Affairs. But I was totally fascinated by the fact that the Swedish Teachers Union has taken professional pay one step further, and they've gone to free market.
Free market.
Uh-huh. So it's, you know, it's long and involved, so I'll just shorten it to about one sentence or two, but they negotiated a countrywide contract, which they do and they put in there a minimum but no maximum for teacher salaries. And their assumption was that teachers would individually negotiate with their own principals. And obviously, sky isn't the limit because principals have to stay within budget. But they also thought that that would do several things. Over 5 years, they assumed and were pretty much told that by the other side, by the government, that they could expect a 20% increase in salaries over 5 years. And they looked back 5 years later, and that was true. It went up 20%. But the second thing they wanted to happen is that they wanted what we call preschool teachers' salaries to be raised, which they were, because of the floor. And then the third thing they wanted to happen was that the hard to fill positions and the like the math and the science positions would be able to negotiate higher salaries, the shortage areas, and they did. So I think that's one thing we want to continue to keep an eye on, and that convention in Sweden was really kind of an interesting eye opener as to, you know, where we can maybe at least theoretically think about the future.
I mean, Finn and all them would love it, free market pay.
Yeah. Which is what causes you to stop and to ponder and think, ooh, well, maybe not.
Maybe if we were a little more socialist, we could pull it off.
Yeah. Okay.
Why don't we get into more of what AFT has been in your life the past 22, 25, 30 years?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you let's start at the beginning. Why don't we just describe your first couple of conventions of AFT?
Well, I was an AFT vice president for 25 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, when was Reagan elected?
80.
And then reelected?
84.
84. So it must have been the 84 convention. Well, somewhere right around in those early 80s there.
When Reagan was invited?
Reagan was invited.
That was like 81 or 82 in Los Angeles.
Was it? Yeah, okay. Well, that was a rather interesting convention for me personally because, of course, Al had tried to convince the vice presidents that we should be polite.
Yes.
And that we should be civil. And that we should do whatever we could do to keep our delegations from, you know, doing anything bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm obviously a rookie vice president, so I think, well, this is going to be interesting. I was one, I think, of only a few vice presidents that refused to have my picture taken with Reagan. I think there were a lot of vice presidents that did have their picture taken with Reagan. But it came time for Reagan to speak, and I was standing on a chair in the back with some folks, and what do I see but I see my entire delegation walking out of the hall with TV cameras on them. And the TV, national TV cameras, and a couple of my delegates, the treasurer, who had been around for a lot of years, and Gail Peterson, and others were interviewed by the national press. So after that demonstration, which of course went everywhere in the national press, I thought, well, that was a nice career in the AFT, but I'm doomed. Al's going to surely wipe me out after that. But I wasn't. I lived to survive another day, but it was one of those things where I just wanted so badly to walk out with them.
But you just couldn't.
But I just thought, I better not.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think various, AFT conventions are always sort of connected with cities. One disappointment is that we haven't had a convention in Minneapolis for about 40 years.
40?
Yeah.
They used to be here all the time.
Well, they used to be here a lot, but
yeah.
In the early days. But then there were certain folks in the travel department that only wanted to take conventions to cities where you could be in one hotel, one gigantic hotel. Mm-hmm. And they wanted the convention to be in the hotel, in a huge ballroom. And so those of us that didn't have that kind of got put way down the list, in spite of the fact that we have an absolutely beautiful convention center here. And we have every other gigantic convention in the Western world comes here because mm-hmm. people love coming here, mm-hmm. particularly in the summer. And we've had conventions where, some of the largest conventions in the country have been here, and they've traveled far and wide to find rooms, but. You know, the AFT convention isn't that big. It's only 3,000 people. Mm-hmm. So I was, and then they did a couple conventions in a row, they did surveys of the convention goers. Well, then, of course, we weren't exactly at the top of that list either.
Yeah, I think that was when we went to Vegas, right?
Yeah. And, you know, people always want to go to San Francisco, and they want to go here, and they want to go there, but... So it was a great disappointment to me that in my 25 years, they never, ever came here for a convention. Hmm. And most they ever came here for was that human rights conference, and it was mostly because I was a women's rights chair. Mm-hmm. And people loved it here, you know, and everybody kept saying, well, gee, we should come here for a convention. And I always say, well, tell the travel department. But... there were some sort of historic conventions here, too. One of the really early conventions in St. Paul was in a lot of the AFT history archives. But...
Yeah, it's my fault. I did. I found that picture. And I pushed it. It was a really great, nice picture of, I think, 30 delegates in December up here. For a convention.
Well, I think there was, I remember sort of a panoramic picture of an early AFT convention I suppose it was in a hotel ballroom in mm-hmm. either Minneapolis or St. Paul.
Yeah.
And it was really quite formal and quite interesting, but I think my very first AFT convention was the Hawaii convention.
That's a nice way to be introduced. Babe.
Right, that's what I thought. So I asked, that was before I was involved at all.
Yeah.
And so that was when Flora Rogge was president of the state MFT, and I asked her if I could go. For some reason or other, she let me go. And that was sort of my introduction. This is a totally irrelevant story other than the fact that it was the convention that had the absolute worst local hosted social that we have ever had at any convention before or since. They put us on buses and took us out to a park, and we sat at picnic tables. And then they brought one of those little cardboard rectangular container plate, kind of with the folded up edges, and in it were some blue chips and some gray poi, and maybe a little mound of sort of like coleslaw, and that was it. So we thought, well, this is just a taste. This is poi, and everybody wanted us to know what poi tasted like. So some people tasted it, some didn't, and put it aside. But we found out later that that was it.
Yeah.
So that was a huge disappointment. Anyway, it's the only place I'd ever been thrown out of a restaurant, too, because I didn't speak the language. There, we went to a Japanese restaurant that was touted in the travel books as being so incredibly authentic. But we finally had to leave because the gentleman behind the counter making the sushi didn't want to have anything to do with people who didn't know how to speak Japanese.
Oh, okay. Very authentic, then.
Mm-hmm.
So you've seen the evolution of AFT conventions, though. The start of Shanker.
Yes.
And the movement from bread and butter.
Yes.
AFT conventions fighting for everything to
to issues-oriented conventions in which there, we developed very long, very detailed, very extensively articulated professional issues and actually discussed them in a convention setting. And that, you know, continues pretty well today as a tradition. They're, of course, are discussed first now in the divisional meetings, but then they're discussed all over again once they hit the floor. And his leadership in bringing those difficult issues to the convention and then having really wonderful arguments about them. And I learned a lot about microphone control and floor leaders and who was you sit back and look at who's selected to be a spokesperson for a particular issue. And I learned also, of course, about the big issue on secret ballot, which was in its early days a really big issue. It's kind of waned now, mostly.
That was mostly the conversation in the 70s, yeah.
Right, and
the secret ballot issue.
Of course, Al insisted that you don't come as a delegate to the AFT at convention as an individual. You're beholden not just to, you know, your own conscience and your own belief systems, but you're representing literally hundreds of members back home as a delegate representing your local and your local members. And when you vote for, you know, as for the 200 members back home, they deserve the ability to be able to see how you voted for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty logical to me, but and it was pretty easy for us too in our local, because we pretty much after the tumult of the 70s, we pretty much followed the party line after I got to be an AFT vice president. So when those votes would come up, be printed, they'd be pretty consistent.
Right.
We did have a guy from Minnesota who ran for AFT vice president back in those, in the 70s. And so our local wasn't always in the Shanker camp, or what turned out to be the Shanker camp eventually, but those were kinds of interesting days. Some of the guys who went before me told, you know, stories about the New Orleans convention where they had a hurricane and they couldn't ever get there.
Hurricane, fire, flood.
Yep. And the one in Chicago with the Fuchs Tower. Somebody stole the Fuchs Tower. And I don't know, there's all kinds of great stories that,
yeah.
You know, the fun part, or at least it used to be, the fun part of unionism is that is always the getting together in the back room after the meetings and telling the stories and hearing the stories from those, you know, who've been leaders before you. And that's where you hone your understanding of life and philosophy and unions, and that's where I learned it too, in the back room from great leaders.
Mm-hmm.
The conventions have gone through, I think the conventions have gone through various iterations to try to involve more people so that more delegates feel that they're a part of the convention. I don't think it's made it yet. And, you know, the committee structure has always been, has changed, and then it's changed again, and then the committee structure, though, in the early days, people were always really paranoid about what would come up at committees and how it was mm-hmm. handled and who was going to chair the committees and what their political stripes and leanings were and whether they could handle a really contentious discussion. And
what were your first assignments on committees?
Well, I pretty much always ended up either in Ed Issues. For a while, I chaired one of the Ed Issues committees. And then after I became Women's Rights Chair, then, of course, I ended up in the Women's Rights Committee, but and chairing it for a while because they trusted that I would be able to, you know, handle the really difficult, some of those difficult issues that come to Women's Rights Committees.
Right.
And so I think those attempts to broaden out the number of people that are involved in committees has only been partially helpful. I think with the newer, younger members, I've tried to convince people that they have to be even more open than they have been now, because there's still a lot of control of microphones and a lot of control of discussion, and the younger people just plain don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've kidded all the way through this about the Gen Xers and the millennials, but they just don't like that form of control. And when they see it happening, and they know it's happening, they can feel it's happening, because they see the same people at the microphones all the time. They just feel that's not right, and that it ought to be more open than that. But
yeah.
the structure, or the just somehow can't trust the delegates, you know, without strong guidance. So I don't know where that's going to go, but
either they have to learn how to rip the tape off the floor and grab that mic.
Right,
that's
which say
Tom,
me.
That's a Tom Hobart story. He actually stole
really?
A microphone.
Really?
He had to leave. It was nice. It just came in
mm-hmm.
to AFT. And they had a plane to catch to get back to New York for something. And, of course, you know, the microphones work back then. And Selden was running it.
Mm-hmm.
And when Selden ran a convention, it was more of his, it was anarchy. It was this trouble. He lost control of conventions last couple of years, so he was doing it. And so he was sitting down. He noticed the microphone was a little too far, and he noticed this guy from Colorado was going to jump up first and talk about the mergers and all that stuff and be against it. And everybody's saying, you'll never make it, you'll never make it. If you have to wait, we're going to miss the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually ripped the duct tape from the wire
mm-hmm.
up when Selden was trying to get control again.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as he said microphone, he yanked the microphone away from this guy. And the guy said, oh, hold it. You know, it's just like, I had the microphone first. And Horace says, I don't know what he's talking about. I have the microphone right here. What are you talking about? So these younger kids have to learn how to...
Well, maybe that would do it. Yeah. I think they're capable of it.
Yeah, they are. They have the energy now.
Right. They have the energy. I just don't think they have the... They somehow don't have the will to challenge authority enough. I mean, the boomers were... You know, that's who we were. Heck, if it's authority, you just automatically challenge it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any difference who it is. And, if it's authority, you either protest it, shove it out of the way, or you take it over, one of the three. But these kids aren't like that. So, which is one reason why we're worried that they're way too willing to follow principles and give deference to principles. Anyway, I digress.
So
AFT.
What did you see happen with Ed Issues? I mean, it started to come into itself in the 80s, and then Nation at Risk hit.
Right.
Was that kind of the catapult for Ed Issues?
Oh, absolutely. But and of course, the turning, one of the huge mileposts was Al's press club speech in 1985. Mm-hmm. In which he laid out all of the components of a professional model and how we ought to respond, and respond by saying, well, there's a lot of truth in that report. There's a lot we have to examine in public education. We aren't perfect. We aren't producing the kinds of graduates with the kinds of skills they need to be internationally competitive and maintain the kind of living that we want to maintain in this country, and that we have to examine ourselves, and we ought to be the ones to do the examining. So that was a pretty radical response, because the rest of the education cartel, including the NEA and the school boards and everybody else, said, "Oh, ain't it awful? You know, things aren't that bad. We're okay. I'm okay. You're okay." and so Al's voice had a very different tone to it, and that's one of the many reasons why he was as respected as he was. He was so respected worldwide as a thinker, and he was a part of every think tank, I think, on education in the entire world. Mm-hmm. And it's always because he did not just follow the traditional response or the expected response. He'd always he'd tend to take a different view and a more and a view that was thought through. That isn't to say that the executive council always appreciated his pronouncements, because I think I already mentioned that it really angered some people that Al was sort of this freelancer leader out there, making pronouncements and making speeches and making policy all by himself, and the executive council was sort of an afterthought. But Al was, confident enough in his own skills and in the soundness of his positions and arguments that I think he thought we could be had, and we always were. And he would often take the discussion in the executive council meetings, one step further, and bring in a speaker or a researcher that was that either nobody'd ever heard of, or somebody who had written a book that he was really interested in, or and usually it was ahead of its time.
Like you would bring in Hirsch and Ravitch.
Right.
And then they would push their stuff in the American Educator.
Right.
So you have the full front.
Right. And so his ideas and were really were really accepted, I think, education-wide to a very unusual degree. I don't think there has been very many leaders in any kind of industry or profession or business that have had that sort of singular influence, and probably won't again in education.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time that he brought in a guy who wrote a book about, a Canadian who wrote a book about labor law. And this was probably 15 years ago. And he was talking about what's happening to labor unions in this country right now.
Hmm.
And how terrible it is and was that the unions in the United States of America have absolutely no protection anymore, that they're going down because they don't have the kinds of protections that they do in other industrialized countries, and that we really, as unions, ought to pay some attention to it. Well, at that time, of course, we didn't have much influence in Congress or in the White House, and it just kept spiraling downhill until now we're, you know, barely picking ourselves up off the floor.
Yeah.
There was always a question about how people got appointed in the AFT and hired into what position, and the suspicion that it was often their politics that got them there.
At the Social Democrats?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for a DFLer from the prairie, I never understood it, frankly. I never sort of, you know, when I got there, I had no clue who Social Democrats were, what they believed. I didn't grasp, you know, that this was, you know, all of these people had this affiliation and what it meant for our international relations and the international department,
mm-hmm.
what it meant for IFTU,
mm-hmm.
the International Federation of Free Teachers Unions, what it meant for the difference between IFTU and WCOTP, all of that stuff. I didn't get any of that. I still don't get much of it, frankly, except, you know, what other people would point out. Well, you know, that person got that job because they're an old Social Democrat, or,
yeah.
you know, that person. But the one that absolutely cracked me up, I was in we were in Tennessee. I think it was the meeting where we went to the Saturn plant.
Okay.
And so we must have been in Nashville.
Probably, or Spring Hill, or wherever.
Well, Spring Hill is where, but there's no hotels in Spring Hill, so I think we were in Nashville. But anyway, I was in a bar, cowboy bar, I think, and David Gray was sitting next to me from Oklahoma,
yeah.
you know. African-American from Oklahoma, well, originally from Detroit. But, and somehow, in the conversation, he said that he was a Social Democrat. And I said, no wonder! Because I couldn't ever put, you know, several things together. And then the second question was, you?
Yeah, right, you.
I mean, the African-American from Oklahoma? Explain to me how that happens.
I have not.
I don't get that. So... usually I was a little more circumspect in my responses than that, but with David it was all right. But
yeah, with David it'd be fun to say.
Yeah. You? So,
I mean, there was even a council meeting where someone got so irate they asked who, because was there an article in Newsweek or Time, one of the New Republics claiming that the AFL-CIO was in bed with Reagan with the Social Democrat stuff. And someone stood up at a council meeting and was like, who here is a member? I want to see and just kind of try to expose everybody. Because another person just didn't understand it.
I don't remember that, but it is could have happened. I mean, usually where you'd figure it out is, you know, again in the bar afterwards, and you'd sort of ask people that you trusted to kind of fill you in on who it was.
Yeah.
And but there were sort of family ties,
yeah,
often with
Well, Kemble was pretty easy to...
Right, but there were, you know, plenty others, and there were also lots of incestuous relationships with AFL-CIO and you know, and lobbyists and all those kinds of things. So, you know, for those folks who lived sort of close to the action, they sort of had a better shot, or who were on the executive committee or who were involved on a more regular basis, I'm sure it was easier for them to figure out. But for those of us who live far away and live in flyover land and only showed up for executive council meetings, it was really hard to figure out.
So you stuck with the education issues.
Right.
Yeah, and women's issues later.
Exactly. And when, you know, as I got some confidence in being called on, because you could always kind of tell where you were placed in Al's esteem, mm-hmm, as to how where you were on the list to be called on.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of moved up, you know, in being called on earlier and earlier. So and then. He told a couple people who were friends of mine that he respected my intelligence and appreciated my sense of humor and my, you know, my contributions. So, you know, he'd never say that, of course. So
no.
I was really, you know, it was reassuring to hear that. And where was I going with that? So it was... the other thing about Al is that I found it absolutely impossible to small talk with him.
You can't. It's impossible.
And I just kept thinking, it's got to be me. There's got to be something I can talk about this to this man about in a buffet line, you know?
Yeah.
So finally, you know, whatever I'd say would end up sounding stupid to me. And then he'd have some rather sharp retort. That, and then I'd think, oh my goodness, I blew that. But I found out later that there were other people that had as difficult a time as, but you know, then he had close friends that seemed to be able to talk about, well, part of the reason is I couldn't talk about any of the things that he was interested in. I couldn't talk about, you know, the technology stuff he liked to talk about, buy all the time, all
right,
the components of the stereo systems at that time and all that stuff. I couldn't talk about baking because,
mm-hmm,
I didn't do that, and I couldn't talk about, sure as heck couldn't talk about wine because I'm a Luddite as far as wine tastes are concerned. I certainly wasn't a collector. So, you know, there wasn't anything that I could relate to or could talk to. So we invited him out here to speak, you know, several several times for several, you know, various occasions. I invited him out one time to see the Public School Academy and Chiron. And that was one of the times when he made this pronouncement to me that class size didn't make any difference. And that kind of made me mad because I thought, it does too. But, you know, he was being cryptic, but of course it doesn't make any difference if that's all you do is lower class size. And
also he's just a man who loves the debate.
Yeah. And that was good. I love to too, but you had to have something that you felt would really advance the conversation and really contribute to the debate. Otherwise, you know, you ought to keep your mouth shut, because he didn't have much tolerance for you know, people who didn't really contribute to the debate.
Yeah.
So if for that reason, those were really rich discussions. And, you know, for those of us who listened well, not everybody's a good listener either, but for those of us who listen well, and I'm a verbal learner, so I learn from listening to things. We learned a lot from Al. He also, of course, was a voracious reader. Mm-hmm. Everywhere he went, he took... he mostly packed books. He didn't pack much other than books. So he'd always read, you know, be reading wherever he went.
Right.
There were always lots of rumors, of course, about Al's personal life, and those were always kind of interesting to listen to.
I
didn't know enough to contribute to the discussion, so I always just listened. But it was one of those lessons in life about how that probably reinforced the saying that power is an aphrodisiac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
When I got confident, I think confident enough in myself, and then I sort of started advancing the women's issues, and it was a time when women's issues kind of waned. And then it started sort of back up again. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of considered the one of the leaders of the modern Women's Rights Committee.
Okay.
'Cause there had been an older Women's Rights Committee, not older women, but a Women's Rights Committee in the past. And then it had kind of waned and kind of, I don't know, gone out of style or something. And then they heard my where I was going with a lot of those issues, and I'd always kind of call them on, you know, where are the women appointees to that advisory committee, and things like that. They
right.
sort of start figuring it out, right? So then I was asked to be chair of the Women's Rights Committee. So I re-energized that committee and gave women again a place and an opportunity to talk about issues important to women. And we re-upped the Women's Rights Conference. Mm-hmm. Started to have women's rights conferences. We started every year and then every other year, and now it's combined and, you know, with all the budget cuts, everything gets cut. And
how did you re-energize? Was it the timing at the moment that women's issues were coming to the forefront, so you're lucky there, or did you have to find something to really get membership around?
I think it was focusing and funneling the issues that were bubbling at the time. And, you know, the AFT has a very broad range of members and beliefs
<Yeah. laughs>
who hold a very broad range of ideas, and so there are women there that are on the whole spectrum of issues and belief systems, and there were lots of women who had interest. There were lots of women who were angry because the issues had been neglected for so long.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of women who are angry because of some of the positions that the male leaders had taken. Angry because the good positions that the AFT had taken weren't emphasized, and still aren't, by the way. Really felt that they were being ignored. That the women were being ignored and their issues were being ignored.
So it was a timing thing.
Plus, starting in the late 70s, early 80s, there were lots of boomer women coming into power.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere, in every organization. It was just sort of our time. And, you know, we'd come up through the protests and the activities, and we were kind of tired of seeing the guys with the bullhorn out in front, we'd been through the women's rights marches, and we'd been through the bra burning and all the rest of that. And so we were ready to take legitimate leadership roles. And so across the country, there were lots of locals that were starting to be led by women that had been previously led by men leaders. So, and there were still lots of issues, that women's issues, that were not resolved, and of course still aren't resolved. And there were, you know, true believers that just felt that an organization of educators and workers ought to be paying more attention to those issues. So we, as I said, tried to focus some. Plus, women's health issues were getting to be a big deal.
Yep.
And hair continue to be a big deal now. And now the interest is in what are these young women going to do as their rights are systematically taken away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And they believe they won't ever be taken away from them. And now you look at the latest Supreme Court ruling and you say, well, it starts.
It's starting to pick away.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminds me of what everybody always says about even new members in unions as a whole. Well, of course we're going to have health benefits. Well, of course we're going to have these days off and this amount of sick leave and this kind of career ladder, because it's always been there.
Right.
The union's just my travel agent to get to Disney World.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being taken away.
And Gen Xers are not joiners.
No.
Because they think they can do it all by themselves. There isn't, since they raised themselves as latchkey kids, they think, I can get myself into or out of anything I want to, you know, anything that happens to me. And so they don't get, you know, collective action, they don't get collective energy, collective, you know, anything. And it's why, you know, why the when something happens to them, for instance, at a school site, and they have to go into a disciplinary meeting, the union rep is there, the union attorney is there, the Gen Xer is there, and the Gen Xer's attorney that mm-hmm. the Gen Xer is paying for. Because mm-hmm. the Gen Xer does not believe that the union attorney is working for them.
Because they're working for the union.
Right.
Which they don't understand.
Right. So
yeah, I can't afford that. I can afford that.
Well, they can't afford it, but they do it anyway.
Yeah.
So it's examples like that of how
trust, and we can do it ourselves.
Yeah, we'll see what happens when and if more of these things just go away.
What's interesting is I just heard that the Girl Scouts are still growing. Even though you have a generation of non-joiners previously to them, and even immediately to them, it's still the millennial members don't join at all as well. But I just heard that they are still growing very fast and very strong worldwide.
Hmm.
I wonder if it has to do with women binding, women bill power base, women's health issues. Who knows?
Well, I think parents also want to keep girls active and involved, and you know, sort of empowered as young women, and being on the soccer team and being on the you know, rugby team or whatever that they're on now.
Yeah.
And being involved in history, they want to keep those young women involved so that they don't get sort of led astray.
Right. But will they continue on? Who knows?
After. Yeah, well, it would be good. I mean, some people are hoping that the millennials are going to save us. They do seem to have more of a worldwide environmental concern, but we'll see.
Right. So back to AFT.
Yep.
They built up the Women's Issues Committee, you know, Women's Committee, but AFT came up to looked at itself with futures. The Futures Committees.
Mm-hmm.
What did you see come out of that redevelopment, reorganizing of AFT?
Or what didn't I see?
Exactly. I was hoping you'd say that.
Well, Futures One, it had some good philosophical statements in it that I use fairly frequently about, you know, it's in one of the three main tenets of Futures One was we have to be as concerned about the success of the enterprise as we are as our own success, because otherwise our members aren't going to have any place to work.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have to pay attention to public education and the Minneapolis Public Schools and make sure that the Minneapolis Public Schools continues to exist, and or our folks are going to be on the street. It reminds me of the story about there is a meat cutter's local in this town who worked for a chain of grocery stores called Country Club, and they had a large G grievance with the Country Club markets about wages and working conditions, and the meat cutters were so angry at Country Club that they knew that if they went on strike, Country Club Foods would go out of business, and they did it anyway. And so they went on strike, and Country Club Foods went out of business. So I did think it was important to emphasize that, you know, we're concerned about teachers as professionals, but we're also concerned about the entities for which we work. Having said that, the preamble, or those opening statements, as good as they were, the rest of the document was basically a political document on organizational structure of the AFT.
Mm-hmm.
And how to give voice to the various divisions within the AFT. So the five divisions then became divisions, and the PPCs were invented, and the Program Policy Council meetings were invented, and the council meetings were supposed to then be having the PPCs bring their issues to the council, and to broaden out the activities and the membership and the empowerment of all the various divisions. So that was about it. There really, in my mind, really was not a view of the future of the labor movement, the future of public education, or the future of public education unions.
It's more of just a restructure to give it a voice.
Right.
Within a union that was shifting.
It was shifting because, of course, you know, grow or die, and broaden your base, or, you know, and because there had been a no rate agreement with the NEA, it was there wasn't much place to go to grow or die. There wasn't much place to organize.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to broaden. Futures 2, I still don't believe was any better. What the organization itself, and I spoke about this until I was blue in the face, both at the council meetings and privately with leaders, that until the organization took a real serious, honest, or had the ability and the openness to take a real honest look at what the organization ought to look like in the future to empower not just the teachers in the classroom, but the locals, since the AFT is made up of good, strong, powerful locals. And until it looked at itself and was able to examine whether it ought to be the top-down, hierarchical, bureaucratic structure that it is now, or whether it could indeed think about, examine other restructuring in the private sector, to become a real a point of sales delivery organization. Because I kept saying all the time that, you know, the place where the teachers meet and involve and touch and feel and articulate and get involved with the union is at the local level, mm-hmm. period. It's also at the, you know, the grocery store shelf level where they interact with Wheaties.
Right.
And it's not at the CEO level. It's not at the distribution warehouse. It's not at the board level. It's not at the officers level. It's not at the state level. It's at the local union. And the local unions, as with Saturn, as with, you know, other wholesale restructuring of how we think about quality management, means that you think first about how the members, the ones who are paying enormous amounts of money to the organization, can get what it needs. And the first line it gets is from the local union. Now, instead, the local union is, the opposite is happening to the local unions. The local unions are being starved out because more money and more effort and more power is going to the state unions, mm-hmm. and the national union is holding on for dear life to its power and old hierarchical structure with its contracts, employee contracts that give everybody a title, and everybody's on a hierarchy, and we model nothing. We as an organization, we don't model a flattened structure. We don't model teaming. We don't model the expectations that we have of schools and school districts. We're really good at telling a school district how it ought to organize itself so that it can push the decision-making, push the budgeting out to the local schools where the teachers and the kids are and the administrators. But do we do that? Absolutely not. We do the opposite. All the money goes upstairs and a little bit trickles back down. And the excuse for bulking up the state organizations is that the state legislature is where all of the decisions are being made. Well, adding a few lobbyists to a lean state organization would be enough to take care of that. But oh no, you know, the state organizations are being bulked up so they do all the professional development. Mm-hmm. They do all of the, you know, organizing through there. They do all everything that the local unions used to do are now the money and the effort and the personnel are going to the state, the bulked up state organizations. So when I you know, think about the lessons of the Saturn, I've been to the Saturn plant 3 times. We've won 2 Saturn awards, our local, and the time we were there with the executive council with Al. And the lessons of Saturn, the lessons of we have the school of Carlson School of Management over here has a Duran chair of, we have, you know, all the reading I've ever done on, and thinking and looking at how, you know, the private sector is reorganizing itself so that the just-in-time delivery and the, well, it's also what Tony Alvarado did in District 2.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Cut down the district office and get that support and that money out to the organizational structure would be the local unions. I argued for the last probably 6 years to reinstitute the local president's conference. Can't even get the local president's conference back on the agenda.
Mm.
But the state fed president's conference is every year in a nice place. And the state Fed presidents are able to get together and talk and share and work together. So I've just been terribly frustrated that the lack of attention and to local unions, the restructuring of the organization from what made it strong.